Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am honored to be speaking for the next few minutes on WGTD's morning show with Kenan Lowe, who is a heroic, courageous figure in several different ways. First of all, an incredibly talented football player who played Division I football for the Oregon Ducks and went on to do some coaching in the NFL, but then willingly stepped out of that world and back into his hometown of Portland, Oregon, ultimately to be head football coach for a high school with a struggling program with a 23 losing game streak. There were a lot of different reasons Kenan Lowe felt moved to make this move, but chief among them was the sudden and tragic death of one of his very, very best friends, a former teammate, due to an opioid overdose. And this was one way for Kenan Lowe to try to heal the brokenness that he was feeling in the wake of that loss. And somehow taking on this huge challenge with this scruffy and struggling football program was perhaps going to be one key ingredient to that. It's an amazing story, made even more amazing by something which happened exactly 3 years ago today. As our listeners hear this interview, it is the 17th of May. On the 17th of May, back in 2019, Kenan Lowe also, in his capacity as a security guard in that same high school, confronted and disarmed a would-be mass shooter and garnered all kinds of incredible attention for himself in that moment in which he displayed another kind of amazing courage. The story of all that is wound up in this incredible book titled Hometown Victory, A Coach's Story of Football, Fate, and Coming Home. The book is co-written with Justin Spiesman. The book is published by Flatiron Books. And Kenan Lowe, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yes, thank you for your time, and I really appreciate you having me on.
This is an incredible book. I want to say right at the outset, I have never played football, never thought about playing football, and I'm actually much more of a music guy, much more of someone who maybe conducts choirs and teaches young men private voice and directs opera productions and so on. So, I mean, my world is very different from yours in terms of professionally what I do. And yet I was really struck again and again and again by the intriguing parallels between what you have experienced as a football coach, and in particular the special challenges of trying to coach this program out of a very challenging situation. I wonder, as you wrote this book, if you thought very consciously about trying to write a book that would be applicable to other people far away from the arenas of football. Did you think very much about that, or is that just a happy accident that your book has so much to say to the rest of us?
Yeah, and I did consciously try to write a story and write my story in a way that it could relate to, you know, the average parent or the student or the student athlete or the sports lover. There's just so much that's happened in my life that is so much more than the sport of football. And yeah, you know, football has been my background and was kind of the way I grew up, and I grew to really love the sport, and obviously I love coaching and passing that sport along to young men as well. But the life lessons are what really, you know, stuck with me, and it's why I really love the game of football. And there's a whole bunch of life lessons in that game. And I tried to put that in the book and share some things about my life, whether it was on the football field or off the football field. I shared some things in my life that I think could help a lot of different people.
You tell us that when you stepped in front of that first group of young guys, when you met them for the very, very first time, first of all, you tell us not a single kid in that room had ever won a game before. So you were starting so much from ground zero. And at one point you said, as you were talking to these young men, they had never heard one of their coaches sound like a coach. What did you mean by that? What were you bringing to this program that it had not had before?
Yeah, I was just trying to bring someone that cared, not only cared about them, but cared about their development in the sport as well, and then cared about seeing them succeed on the football field. And you know, through all my lessons I've learned on the field, you know, I played the game for so long and obviously coached it. There's just so many life lessons that apply to the football field and off the football field. So I knew, you know, I wanted to stand up there and tell those young men, obviously from that day forward, that we were going to be family, because I was going to be a part of their life and their fight as well. But also that, you know, I was there to teach them and to mentor them and to show them how to succeed on and off the field.
Your own background was difficult in that your father left the family rather abruptly when you were pretty young, but he had taught you some important life lessons, and in particular had sort of given you a great start in the game of football. And you tell us, I channeled my sadness into football. Can you tell us what you mean by that, and how was football something in which you could channel your sadness?
When I grew up, you know, like you said, you know, I grew up with a single mother and a single mother household. I had an older sister and a younger brother. And then once my dad had to kind of leave the family and go fight his own fights and his own demons around when I was about 8 years old, you know, all of a sudden I looked up and I really had no mentors in my life. I really had no one I looked up to, because there wasn't really a lot of people that looked like me. And obviously my dad wasn't around anymore. But at 8 years old, you know, I looked at my younger brother and realized, well, that's my responsibility now. You know, he's 8 years younger than me, and if I turned out to be a bad person, then he'd probably copy me in all those ways. And if I turned out to be a good person, then he'd probably be a good person as well. So I grew up really fast and understood that I had an influence on people from a young age, and that started with having a little brother in a single mother household. And, you know, as far as mentors, you know, I really look back and I look at the game of football. And the game of football is where I really learned how to be a young man, and really where I learned how to push through adversity and pick myself up off the ground. And so I really looked at the game of football as my mentor. You know, when I played the game of football, and if I was going through something at home or going through something inside of me, once I touched the football field and I was around my teammates and playing the game that I love, all of a sudden nothing mattered. And that's what I mean when I say I channeled all of that into the game of football. And then, you know, with that emotion that I put into the game, I actually started to become a pretty good athlete. And then, you know, it kind of carried me through to get a full ride scholarship to college.
We're speaking with Keenan Lowe, and we're talking about his book, Hometown Victory, A Coach's Story of Football Fate and Coming Home. The book is mostly about his experience going back to Portland, Oregon, leaving behind a coaching career in the NFL to become the head coach of a struggling high school football team there, and a team with a 23 losing game, losing streak, and dealing with the many young men, some of them quite talented, but many of them with all kinds of incredible struggles and difficult issues that they were trying to resolve. I was really struck, Coach Lau, by something you said about one of your most talented players. I think this is when you're talking about Trey Singleton. And you said in the case of this young man, and I'm sure it was true of others, for Trey, football was his sanctuary, the place where he could be himself. Can you take us behind those really intriguing words, how for some of these troubled men, young men struggling in other arenas, how football could be a sanctuary where they could be themselves?
Yeah, and I tried to pass these lessons to these young men during my whole time with them, things that I learned when I was younger. And that was something I learned at a young age, like I said. You know, all of a sudden, I didn't really have any mentors or anyone to look up to. So when I went to football, nothing mattered in the world to me in those 2 hours of practice or games. And it really was, it became my sanctuary. So I looked at Trey and I saw a young man that was just like me when I was younger. And I looked at all of my kids and I could relate to all of them in so many different ways. And he was a troubled kid and just such a good heart, such a good smile, such a good, you know, good kid all around. But, you know, he suffered through just some challenges because, you know, he also had a rough go at it at his life. And I tried to teach him and explain to him that, you know, when you're doing extracurriculars, you know, like football or like you said, you're involved with music. It's kind of the same thing. When you go to these extracurriculars, whether it's a sport or an activity, that's a place where you can just be yourself and nothing really matters for those hour or 2 hours that you're around your friends and you're around your teachers or coach. Nothing really matters. And I just think extracurriculars, whether it's sports or activities, music, I just think it's so important for the development of young people.
Right. Well, in the case of this Trey Singleton, you know, we should say his difficulties at home were incredibly serious, including long stretches where he was essentially homeless. And I was so struck at the point in the book when finally Trey opens up to you about what's going on and all the difficulties that are in his life, you said something to the effect that I was heartbroken and inspired. And I thought that was so interesting because I think a lot of people would only assume the first part, that you would hear a story like that and you would find it heartbreaking. But you also found it inspiring, of course, because in the wake of all of that, in the face of all that, Trey and some of these other young men, it was amazing what they were still trying to accomplish and able to accomplish despite all that.
Yeah, it was inspiring to say the least. You know, I really got a good perspective on just life in general. And that's all, you know, I think that's all we can do as human beings is just try to gain perspective so we can understand other people better. And by me meeting Trey and kind of living his life with him and fighting his fights with him, and then he opens up for me and obviously tells me that he's been homeless for the last year, it really put my life into perspective. All of a sudden, the daily problems or challenges I went through, or even the challenges I went through as a kid, all of a sudden they seem pretty small because I'm sitting there talking to a 15-year-old that didn't have a place to live for a year, you know? So it really put things into perspective and it really opened my eyes very early on at that job at Park Rose as their coach and mentor and lifeline. It really opened my eyes that this job was just so much bigger than just coaching football. It was really, you know, a job to really provide a real mentorship and for these young men, they really, really needed it. And I was happy I was there for them. Mm.
And it's an incredibly heartwarming, uplifting story. Although we got to say you are frank about all of the difficulties along the way. And for one thing, you were confronting a culture at this high school that was about the last thing you would want for a football program. That is, this was a place where the students found it easy to quit, or they quit easily. And this was something you were desperate for them not to quit. And one way or another, you were able to shepherd them through. And we should also say that you weren't alone in this struggle, that there's a point early on in the story when, in your words, one became two. And you were able to, after a lot of fruitless attempts, you were finally able to sign up a former teammate of yours by the name of Brian Jackson, or B-Jax, who became your right-hand man and made an enormous difference for the better. You were an incredible team, and I'm sure as you look back, chances are you would not have succeeded as you did without him.
Yeah, exactly, and I got a chance to write about kind of what it was like right after I got the job. You know, I was so excited, and then you know, I realized, well, I guess I have to, you know, have a staff as well. I can't do it all by myself. And I go through the Rolodex of my phone and I call all my friends from, you know, from Portland in the area and former teammates in college. And every single person I called and asked to help me coach this team said no. Every single one said no. And until I got to my former college teammate, Brian Jackson, who was living in Portland. He's actually from Alabama, came to the University of Oregon from Alabama out of high school. And so he was living in Portland after college, and everyone said no until I dialed his number. And you know, I got a chance to explain our relationship in college. We were more rivals than anything else, but that rivalry and that competitive spirit that we had, it really grew a very strong mutual respect for each other. And like I said in the book, he knew he was going to get the best of me, and I knew I was going to get the best of him because we had been there and done that. We had been teammates for 4 years already. So when I asked him, he didn't really flinch. You know, he could tell I needed somebody to help me out, and I explained to him the challenge, the uphill climb that we were going to be in for at Park Rose High School and helping these young men change their lives around. And he jumped on board, and I honestly could not have done it without him.
Well, you take us through that long summer of workouts and to the fall when you all go to what is supposed to be the playing field to find that the grass isn't mowed, there are no lines painted, there's no field at all, and of course you have almost nothing in the way of equipment and so little tangible around you from which to derive hope, and yet one way or another, that losing streak eventually is broken. And you tell the story of that first season with you as head coach in really riveting detail. The highs, the lows, the joys, the tears, all wrapped up in that very eventful season. We do want to talk about a dramatic day at the high school. As I said, exactly 3 years ago today, as this interview airs, when you as a security guard were called to display great courage, and also, as it turns out, great sensitivity in a moment that could have ended very, very tragically. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about, this dramatic moment that occurred in May of 2019.
Yeah, I was coaching football there, obviously, and after the football season, you know, I had an opportunity to work inside the school full time as a campus security guard. And you know, I jumped at that opportunity, especially once the football season was over, because I wanted to continue my work and my mentorship for my kids. But then it also was an opportunity to get to know some of the other kids that didn't play football in the school. So I worked there as a security guard. And then became the head track coach. So I was, you know, I had three jobs in the school and was very involved. And during my time in those three jobs, I got a chance to really understand the kids and really walk with them in their lives and truly understand the struggles that they were going, you know, going home with and coming to school with. And you know, I really got to understand them. And one day, in 2019, I get a call as a security guard to just go to a certain classroom and go grab a student and just bring them to the office. And it was the kind of call you get 20 to 30 times a day. You know, as easy as just delivering notes or bringing a kid to the office because his parents are going to pick him up. So I get a call and I think nothing of it. Just, I go to this certain classroom where they ask me to go and I go inside that classroom and ask for the student and then the student's not there. So 30 seconds later, you know, as I'm in the classroom looking for the student, the door pops open, and you know, I'm 4 feet from the door, so I'm right next to the door, and the door pops open, and there's a young man standing there with a black trench coat and a shotgun, and he pulls out the gun out of his coat, and at that very moment, the whole classroom obviously got very, very scared. And, you know, we're screaming and running out of the back of the classroom. And everything seemed to go into slow motion in that moment for me. You know, I was 4 feet from him right next to the door, standing there right in front of him. And, And as he, you know, was standing there in the doorway and I saw the gun, it seemed to go in slow motion. I was able to look at his eyes first, and I could tell it was just a young man that wasn't all there. I could tell he was going through some sort of crisis, and he was scared. That's the first thing I noticed, is he was very scared. And, you know, he grabbed that gun, and then he turned it on himself. And as he, you know, pulled out the gun and turned it on himself, I lunged forward and end up getting my two hands on the gun. And then we end up having a bit of a wrestling match inside that classroom, and banged against the file cabinet, and we're both kind of struggling for the gun. And we kind of spill into the hallway, and I'm able to get the gun away from him. And that's where that viral video picks up, that a lot of people around the world and country have seen, of me holding him back with one hand and me holding a shotgun in the other hand. Once I got the gun, I was able to hand it to a teacher nearby. And at that moment, there was no threat. You know, the kid was just a young kid crying out for help. I could have easily slammed him on the ground or held him down, but my heart told me that he needed help, that he needed someone to hug him, and he just needed love in that moment. So I gave him a hug, and he told me, he said, "Nobody cares about me. I was just trying to hurt myself." And I looked him in his face and told him that I care about him and that I was there to save him. So it was a very surreal moment, and you know, I'm just very happy that I was able to trust my instincts, and my instincts led me to saving the kid, but also you know, saving the school from a traumatic experience as well.
Right. You say at one point, as you describe that scene, "I expected to see the devil in those eyes, but I didn't. I saw quite the opposite. This young man was crying for help. He needed love." And of course, that's what you gave him in that long bear hug of an embrace. And so much of your story is about looking twice at some of these young men, in many cases men who were seen as troublemakers, written off, and you saw potential where the world often failed to see that potential. And some of the hardest cases were the ones that for which you had the softest heart. Can I ask you one last real quick question?
Yes, of course.
I wonder about what it felt like to tell this story about these young men whom you coached, and what it's like to share with the world so many facets of their various stories. Some of these stories are of when they fail you or disappoint you or fail themselves and fall short of their potential. And I wonder, you know, first of all, did you need to go to each of these young men and ask for their permission? Are their names changed? Are there ways in which these stories are in any way sort of softened or, I don't know, whitewashed? Or is this a real unvarnished telling of the stories of these young men? And what was it like for you to share that with the world in this way?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a real story. These young men, right when I started this journey, I sat down with a lot of those young men on my team, and you know, some stories didn't make it in. I mean, there was a, you know, I probably could have wrote a couple books on some of the other stories we went through, as far as the kids I got to coach and some of their backgrounds. But I was able to highlight a handful of the students I got a chance to work with, and early on in the process, I was able to speak with them and sit down with them, and told them that I was going to write a book, and they could be as involved or you know, as involved as they wanted, and that they could change their names, and we can, you know, I can leave certain things out of their stories if they would like. And they were all very very excited to be able to have me put them in the book, and they, you know, they all jumped at the opportunity to you know, to be a part of this project, because they understood, especially after our time together was done, and after they graduated, they understood what we went through, you know, in retrospect. They understood how much they learned and how much their lives changed, and I understood how much they changed my life. So, yeah, it was a really fun process, and I got to interview a bunch of them and just make sure my facts were straight and that their stories were told the correct way, and that they were happy with the way it was told. So, and, you know, it was an exciting thing to really go on this journey for the last 2 years of writing this book. And I'm very proud of the way it turned out, and I'm excited for everyone to read it.
Very good. Well, it is a wonderful book. And again, I say most emphatically, one does not even need to be a football fan or a former player or aspiring coach to find this book absolutely riveting and deeply moving. Again, it's titled Hometown Victory, A Coach's Story of Football Fate and Coming Home, published by Flatiron Books and the author Keenan Lowe. Keenan Lowe, congratulations on a terrific book and congratulations on all the great success that you have already achieved with so much of life still ahead of you. We wish you only the very, very best, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And I want to take a moment to read a short passage from Keenan Lowe's book, Hometown Victory. This is from a chapter that deals with something that we spent very little time talking about in the interview, and that is the real-life tragedy, the loss of his close friend that really set Keenan Lowe on this pathway towards returning to his hometown of Portland, Oregon. Chapter 2 of the book is called Losing a Brother, and here is just a portion of it. This takes up midsummer after some of these summer workouts have been occurring and the boys have been working hard. "Hey guys," I said, "there's that pizza restaurant around the corner. Let's call it early today and go eat. Coach K is buying. Get cleaned up and meet me there in 20. The small group of players looked at each other, realizing this was their opportunity to avoid the next 15 minutes of torturous burnouts, and were out of there as quick as the words came from my mouth. My assistant coach B-Jax and I were left to rack the weights and close down the workout room. He looked at me somewhat unsure about going out with the players and said, 'You sure about this, coach?' I didn't hesitate. 'Yeah, why not? We're family. Besides, these boys earned it. It would be good to spend some time with them outside of the weight room.' Round Table Pizza was just a block away from Park Rose High. I walked over with B-Jax, and as we opened the restaurant door, we could see the boys had already gotten a table and were ordering drinks. We sat, and I ordered 3 large pizzas and some wings for the table. 'Look, guys, we're a family,' I said. 'It's important we spend time together outside of the gym as well. This isn't just about getting your body strong and prepared for the season. It's also about trusting one another and realizing we're all in this together.' Trey, marinating in my comments, looked up from his giant glass of soda. 'I don't mean to be rude, coach, but you never did answer RJ's question. Why did you leave the NFL? Why are you here with us at Park Rose?' It was a fair question, one I had thought about and clearly knew the answer. 'Well, I came back because one of my old teammates, his name is Taylor Martinek. All of us on his team called him T-Mart. I met Taylor my freshman year of high school, a lot like how you guys met. We were together not too far from here, at Jesuit.' The kids began to boo, as Jesuit was a state powerhouse and local private school. 'I know, I know. I wasn't from around there, so I didn't really know anyone. We had just moved across the city so I could go play ball there. My goal was to play college football, so my mom moved us across the river so I would have a better shot. A lot of those kids from Jesuit High School came from Catholic elementary and middle schools from all over, and I came from a public school. I was the new kid in more ways than one. We met at the football camp and became friends from the jump. Taylor lived close to the school, a 5-minute walk, so a lot of guys on the freshman football team were coming from the other side of the city. Taylor opened his house to us to sleep over, so we didn't have to wake up early and travel across town. He was a good dude. That's just who he was. Ever since that freshman football camp, we were best friends. All through high school, we'd hang after practice, chase girls, go to parties, movies, you know, those high school things. We had a lot in common, but the biggest thing was our love for the game. That's what we did and who we were." Trey cut me off. "What position did he play?" I responded with pride. "Middle linebacker, like you. The dude was a savage on the team. First team All-State. Under those Friday night lights, you couldn't touch us." "When I was a senior in high school," I continued, "he hurt his shoulder. His labrum was torn, but he passed on the surgery and decided to finish the year and get it fixed after the season. That's when things really started to change for him. That was the first time he was exposed to painkillers. The pit in my stomach started to swell up again just thinking about it. Just 2 years ago, T-Mart was here. both of us, 24-year-old college graduates with our whole lives ahead. After high school, I played for the Ducks, and Taylor went on to play at Portland State once he healed up. We stayed in touch and spoke every couple of days, but Taylor suffered a few more injuries over the course of the next couple of years. More injuries meant more surgery, and with those surgeries meant more pills. And things went from bad to worse. The injuries piled up, and Taylor had to quit playing ball altogether. It crushed him. Having something you love get taken away from you, especially when it's out of your control, is tough. That's when he started to become addicted to the pills. He became like a lot of people in our country who get prescribed opioids to stop the pain, but then all of a sudden need them just to get through the day. It's a scary thought, a pill designed to help you, but ultimately can harm you if you're not careful. As I talked, I hardly even noticed the waitress had returned with another waiter. They were holding 3 extra-large pizzas on a bucket of wings. They placed them throughout the table, and you didn't have to tell these kids to go ahead and start. They dove right in, grabbing the food as if they hadn't eaten before. It was the after-workout hunger and insatiable appetite you feel after you have burned out your muscles. They filled their plates and started stuffing their faces, respectfully looking back at me, signaling that I should continue. I could tell he was starting to slip to a dark place. He started acting more and more out of character. He started to get in trouble with the law. One week it would be a speeding ticket, and the next it would be a fight in the streets of downtown Portland. The pills continued, adding Xanax to his list of struggles. The life he was living started to spiral out of control, and we did our best to help get him right. It hurt to replay the reality of what happened. Taylor wouldn't talk about things that were bothering him. He was never openly emotional, but I could see he was hurting, struggling. He comes from a good family. His dad spent 20 years in law enforcement and served as the chief of police in Vancouver, Washington for a number of years. His mom is an educator, a school district administrator for Portland Public Schools. That's the hardest thing about addiction. It doesn't care who you are, where you're from, or how much money you do or don't have. Addiction can affect anyone. Taylor wanted to stop, but he couldn't. Addiction is not a problem caused by the lack of willpower, but an illness that needs treatment. T-Mart became a pro at suppressing his struggles and keeping things inside while putting on a mask that made it seem like he was okay. Despite his best efforts, I could see the changes in him, and it broke my heart. Trey looked up from his pizza, young, innocent, and with a stone face. "You still hang with him, Coach? How's he doing now?" I paused for a moment. To this point, I hadn't spoken much about Taylor to anyone. In some ways, this was a cathartic conversation of sorts, one I had not expected to have with a bunch of high schoolers, but one that I personally needed. I swallowed, choked back some of the tremendous emotions that boiled inside, and told him the truth. Nope, he passed away. The boys weren't sure how to respond. You could tell they wondered if they had done something wrong by asking. Even though we had spent the past 4 weeks together day in and day out, we hardly knew anything about each other. "It's okay, Trey," I said. It was last January back in 2017. I was coaching in San Fran, and I got a call from one of our friends one evening. The first thing he said was, "It's Taylor." And I said, "What happened?" He took a long pause, then said, "He's gone." That was tough. He told me Taylor had accidentally overdosed. It was like a bad dream. As soon as I got off that call, I was a wreck. That night I replayed our whole 10-year friendship. I thought back to how hard the last couple of years had been for him. I questioned myself, could I have done more? I knew he was down bad, but I was in San Francisco. I wasn't there for him. "Damn, Coach," RJ said, "that's rough." "You always wonder if you did enough for your friend," I said, "but I never thought it could happen to him. Things like that only become real when it happens close to you." Life is filled with difficult lessons, but when you're young, you feel invincible. After graduating college and finishing successful football careers, Taylor and I thought we were on top of the world. But sadly, many former athletes just like Taylor end up with addiction problems. Ultimately, his problems stemmed from his surgeries, and his demons came from prescription pills. It was almost like a trap. I came home after Taylor passed away. It was right after the football season with the 49ers. I was coming home and didn't plan to be here for too long, but ended up reflecting on my life a lot during that time. We mourned as friends and family, and as I reflected, I always came back to the feeling that I just needed to be back in Portland. I was broken and was looking for the meaning of his loss. I wasn't concerned about my career and the status of being a coach in the NFL anymore. At that time, nothing made sense to me, but home felt right. That fall, my brother Trey started his senior year of high school at Taylor's and my alma mater. Coaching and sharing the game of football with my younger brother was something that I always enjoyed and cherished. At that point, I had been gone for the last 7 years. I thought about all the time I'd missed and the experiences I'd never get back. I looked at the people that mattered the most to me, and they were all here in Portland. Time is something you never get back. So I made my decision. So that was really ultimately what brought me back. I didn't want to miss any more of the moments, the special times with my brother, friends, and family. So last year, that's where I was, coaching my brother, a Jesuit. I volunteered. They didn't pay me or anything. It felt right. It felt like where I was supposed to be. The kids had stopped eating, and it was clear they were hanging on my every word. This wasn't the first time they had encountered addiction, loss, and pain. Some, if not most, had parents in jail and family members struggling with drugs and alcohol. Sadly, this was an all too familiar story. But something special happened with us at that table filled with pizza crust and chicken bones. The more I opened up to my guys, the more they respected me. We didn't just share a meal. We shared a connection. Coming back here to Portland, I said, was more for me than for anyone else. I needed it at the time. I still need it. I had a good time coaching last year, but after my brother graduated, it made sense to figure out what's next. And that's when I found you guys. I smiled and gave them a head nod. I was a coach without a team, and you guys were a team without a coach. I could tell maybe for the first time over the course of our short time together that these kids were starting to trust me. They realized I was one of them. The same experiences, the same pain, the same challenges. We were one and the same. It wasn't coach and players. We were a bunch of guys who loved football, having pizza and wings, having an honest talk about life. I looked around at the kids as the conversation shifted to a lighter subject. I felt my best friend Taylor looking down on us. I couldn't help but think he was with me. And in a lot of ways, Taylor was the reason why I was there at Park Rose High School, still healing and still searching for a new purpose. An excerpt from the book Hometown Victory, A Coach's Story of Football, Fate, and Coming Home by Keenan Lowe. I should mention that Coach Lowe is back in Portland and back coaching and mentoring high school football players. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show archives. On several occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with Brad Meltzer. The first time, actually, about a graphic novel he took part in involving many of the heroes of DC Comics, and then more recently talking about books he had written about heroes for his son, heroes for his daughter, and now focusing on a very specific hero or heroine, namely Rosa Parks, in a really lovely children's book called I Am Rosa Parks. And I'm very excited to speak with Brad Meltzer about Rosa Parks, her legacy, and what it was like to try to take this story and share it with young readers in this particular way, in this lovely book called I Am Rosa Parks, a dial book for young readers from Penguin. Brad Meltzer, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Always good to be back. Thanks so much.
Good to be talking to you. And it's always great, of course, to remember the legendary Rosa Parks. Tell us briefly about your own connection to this story. When do you first remember even knowing about Rosa Parks?
You know, the book is dedicated to my grandmother, who passed away a couple years ago, and it has to be from her. You know, my family was not political at all. My dad used to not vote because he thought it would make him get jury duty. That's how political my family was, which was an insane thing in my eyes, but that was how he did it. And it was my grandmother who was the political one and kind of told us these stories. And, you know, for me, the stories, yes, of course, in the book we tell the stories that you know about Rosa Parks, but the goal is to teach our kids even the stories they don't know. We show kids when Rosa Parks was herself a child. So you see that when Rosa Parks was 11 years old, a boy on roller skates came racing by and shoved her down to knock her over and bully her. And Rosa Parks popped back up and shoved the boy back. Now, the boy was white. Rosa Parks, of course, was black. And at the time, you didn't do such things. So this white mother of the boy comes racing over, gets in Rosa Parks' face and says, listen, you know, I'm going to have you put in jail forever. And when you're 11 years old and some woman's yelling at you, you know, most kids would go running. Rosa Parks stands up for herself in that moment and says, listen, your son picked this fight. I just don't want him bothering me anymore. And sure enough, that mother and that son never pick on Rosa Parks or bother her again. And I want my daughter to hear that story. I want my sons to hear that story, that sometimes you have to stand up to the bully. And in fact, the amazing part is a couple months ago when my son was being bullied, my older son said to my younger son, you need to be like Rosa Parks. You need to stand up to that bully. And my younger son said, yeah, I need to be like Rosa Parks. And I love the idea that to my young son, Rosa Parks is as vital today as she's ever been.
Mm. As you are painting the picture of the kind of life that she was living as a young person in the segregated South, we're reminded about the specter of white and colored elevators and white and colored drinking fountains. And I love the little moment when you show the very young Rosa Parks walking up to a so-called colored drinking fountain with a really interesting expectation, which proves not to be true. Tell our listeners about this image.
Yeah, this was actually something that I found. Rosa Parks actually believed when she was younger than when she saw the words colored water fountain that it meant that the water was came out in multicolors. So you see in the picture a rainbow water fountain is coming out. The water is rainbow colored. And, of course, that's not what colored means at all. But those were her own thoughts. We didn't make that up. We actually pulled it from her own words. And I just, you know, for my kids, the amazing part is they don't know these stories. They never saw this. And to see that this little girl could overcome those obstacles, that she could find the strength within herself, that's what I want to leave for my kids. And the goal for us long term, it's never just about one book. You know, we're doing I Am Albert Einstein in September. We're doing I Am Jackie Robinson in January. And the goal long term is we want to build a library and help you build a library for your kids, for your grandkids, for your nieces and nephews, that you can give them real heroes that they can look up to. Because you know what? We're a country right now that needs heroes.
Right. One thing that was interesting in the way you told this story was that Rosa, as a youngster, has sort of a sidekick, some young boy who is kind of side by side with her. And the thing that's sort of interesting is that this young black boy will be experiencing the same thing that Rosa is, namely segregated schools, and he will react as though certain things are great, and Rosa is the one who sees the injustice. Something like the fact that the school year at a black school would tend to be much shorter than the school year for the white school, because all these blacks would be busy working in the field for part of the year. And I thought that was an intriguing point to make, that sometimes two people can experience the same reality, and both of them might not even realize, to the same extent at least, that they are being dealt an injustice. And that seems to be something about which Rosa Parks, even early in her life, had exceptional clarity about.
Oh, no question about it. And that's also there because, you know, our readers here are little kids. And when I tell my kids, my little kids, my 12-year-old, my 8-year-old, even my 6-year-old, when I tell them that, you know, you only have to go to school for part of the year, they think that's a great thing. No school. So I need to have a voice in the book that reflects their own opinions to see, no, That's not what we're rooting for here. You want equal schools. You want to have the same thing. And Rosa Parks, you better believe, understood it. When she was a little girl, she used to actually take her books home every day from school because they were worried that someone was going to come and burn the school down every day. That is a tough little fighter. You know, we've turned Rosa Parks into this matronly old woman as if she's got glasses and a walker. You know how old Rosa Parks was when she sat on that bus? 42 years old. She was in her prime, and she was always a fighter. You know, she used to say, when they said, you got to go to your own water fountains and drink there, she was like, I'm not going to drink there. I'd rather go thirsty. Mm. When they said, you have black-only elevators down the hall, she would say, you know what, I'll take the stairs. She was always fighting back. We just happened to turn her, history turned her into this kind of matronly old woman. But that's not the right story. That's not the full story. And I love that in I Am Rosa Parks, we get to give kids that real picture of who she was.
Right. And the fact that that gesture of defiance on that city bus was not sort of the last straw. No, I've had enough. Finally, I'm going to do something about it. It was actually all but inevitable that that would happen with Rosa Parks because that had already been her legacy. In some respects, although it was a dramatic moment, it should not have come as a surprise to anybody who knew her and knew the way she had lived her life up until then.
Sure, right. We see her as a seamstress. She also worked for the NAACP, making sure that people's voices were heard. The amazing part that I found that I never knew was that when she stood up to that bus driver wasn't a stranger. She actually had been kicked off personally his bus before, that she entered the bus through the front that he was driving. And he said, you got to go enter through the back. And he literally grabbed her by the shirt sleeves and threw her off the bus. So she wasn't standing up to a stranger that day when she stood up on the famous bus. She was standing up to someone who had kicked her off before. She was standing up to another bully in her life. And that takes, to me, even more guts. So, you know, I always, you know, it's funny because I get parents who say to me, I was reading this for my kids and I learned stuff I didn't know myself. And I love, that's the goal of the book, so you can share with your kids these real life heroes.
Mm. Can you say a quick word about the talented person who's responsible for the wonderful illustrations here that accompany your text?
I'd be honored to. Sure. No, our artist is Chris Eliopoulos. And what I love about Chris, you know, when you do a children's book, usually the publisher picks out who the artist will be, and you may not know that person. Chris is a dear friend of mine, and I picked him and said, this is why we need to do this with. And the reason is because Chris's art is kind of is influenced by almost from Peanuts from Charlie Brown mixed with Calvin and Hobbes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to do cute, it's easy to do funny. What it's really hard to do is do heart. And that's what those artists had, is heart. And so when he's drawing Rosa Parks as a little girl or doing I Am Abraham Lincoln or I Am Amelia Earhart, you get so much heart from him. Mm. And suddenly kids fall in love with that and they react to that in ways that I wish I could take credit for, but it's really a testament to his amazing art. That's what's going to make your kids turn the pages, is he makes them really fun and lovable.
And I appreciate very much that at the end of the book, we have a few photographs of the real Rosa Parks. I mean, in
that
a sense,
vital to me.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and we have the real
because,
Rosa Parks.
You know what Parks, kids do is they read.
Go ahead.
And what kids do is they, I was going to say, I'm sorry, what kids do is they read the book, and then their first question is always, is that real? And so at the end of every book, we put a double-page spread that shows, you want to see, here's a picture of Rosa Parks on that bus we just told you about. You see the real picture.
Hmm.
Here she is when she's a little girl in that schoolhouse. That's her school. We didn't make that up. It's real. And kids, their minds explode in that moment because they go, oh, my gosh, this really happened.
Right. This is
and
not make-believe.
That was the vital part.
Absolutely.
That's right. You know, it's one thing when you read a book about a happy dragon and you go, oh, and you take the lesson, you know it's not real. But think of how much more powerful it is when you get to teach a kid that history is not a bunch of dates and facts you memorize, but history is a selection process. And it chooses every single one of us every single day. And the only question is, do you hear the call? And this is the call. These books will hopefully be the call for your child. Let them fall in love with history and see how important and how powerful they can be themselves.
I Am Rosa Parks is part of a book series called Ordinary People Change the World. It is I Am Rosa Parks, a dial book for young readers, an imprint of Penguin, and the author, Brad Meltzer. Brad Meltzer, thank you so much for creating this beautiful book. We look forward to the other books which are to follow it. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much, Greg. Always great to be back.
And indeed, there are more than 30 books in this series tackling important figures in history like Abraham Lincoln, Amelia Earhart, Jackie Robinson, Harriet Tubman, Helen Keller, and many, many more. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jory Lewis, the author of a very interesting book called Slaves for Peace.